You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Brant Williams, sitting in for Carrie Miller. More than 8,000 Starbucks coffee shops will close this afternoon for what the company calls racial bias training. Earlier this year, a white store manager called the police on two African-American men who were there for a meeting but hadn't purchased anything. There's been a rash of similar incidents. By my count, at least 8 of them in the last 2 months, which have occurred across the country. Maybe you've seen some of the videos pop up in some of your social media feeds. In each instance, a white person has called police on Black or Native American people who are apparently engaged in non-criminal activity, whether that's using charcoal to barbecue in the park, shopping for clothes, napping in a dorm lounge, or touring a university campus. We're going to talk about that this hour, and I have two guests with me. I have Raj Sedhuraju. He's an assistant professor in the School of Law Enforcement at Metropolitan State University. He leads implicit bias training around the state on behalf of Restorative Justice Community Action. Raj, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And also joining us by the phone is Vernay Myers. She's an inclusion strategist and cultural innovator and author of Moving Diversity Forward, How to Go From Well-Meaning to Well-Doing, and What If I Say the Wrong Thing? Vernay, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Happy to be here with you.
Thanks. And of course, I want to hear from you. Give me a call at 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828. And particularly, if you're a person of color and you've been a target of a seemingly unwarranted police call, tell me about it. Or if you're white and you've had a chance to call the police on a Black or brown person, tell me why you decided to do that. What were some of the factors that led to the call? First, I want to go to my guests, though, and I'll start with you, Vernay. Just give me a sense of when you heard about these instances, that we were talking about this morning, what was your first reaction?
You know, in some ways, it's not surprising because it happens all the time. We used to have an expression, driving while Black, but apparently it has expanded to be just like walking around, napping, shopping, eating while Black. I mean, in some ways, it is. We kind of know now that there is this idea of implicit bias and ways in which people just presume guilt before, and it happens a lot with Black and brown and poor people. But now it seems to have gotten even worse.
Sure, and in some of these instances, I'm wondering if you think there were opportunities for the callers to perhaps pause for a minute before they picked up the phone to call and went out to actually interact with the people that they were suspicious about. Have you thought about that?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good point because I think a lot of the calling is about a discomfort or inability to actually relate to people who are different from you. So while if it was a person who you felt comfortable with or similar to, you might go and ask, you know, what's going on here, or what do you, or did you know this, or I'm wondering about that. But when it's a person who you see as different from yourself and add maybe more, you have a bias against them or a stereotype of them being dangerous or more likely to be criminals, all of those kind of what we call automatic associations create an instinctive action, sort of very automatic action. And so people don't think and they go right into pretty much acting on stereotypes. And I think if they didn't have those stereotypes, their behavior might be very different.
Sure. And my guest in the studio, Raj, he's nodding his head at what you were saying. Raj, first of all, give me your reaction when you started hearing about some of these incidents that we've been seeing in the news.
I'm not surprised at the incidents and the overwhelming idea of dismissing or discounting or diminishing the presence of people who don't fit their narrative or who should be in that space and who should not be in that space. So whether it's calls based on neighborhoods that don't have certain presence of communities, and then suddenly you see that particular community that you have fundamentally dismissed from being present in that space, then it leads to what happened in Falcon Heights, right? Yeah. The killing of a young man who was driving, who was purportedly seen as the person who was associated with a robbery that happened in a convenience store.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think this Berna is right in hi, Berna.
By the way, how are you, Russ?
I am well. She's talking about this presumption of guilt even before we find out about the humanity of that person. I'll give you a quick example. I was a dean. I was an associate dean of diversity initiatives at a private college. The name of the college would be left out.
Okay.
I went along with the admissions process to recruit students, future students for an undergraduate program. And in the process, I found out how recruitment is done. And we went to predominantly a African-American sort of career fair session. And lots of students, all of young people, come through that process. And I'm watching my fellow counselors, admissions counselors, not reaching out to anybody, not engaging them, not building a sense of relationship. And so, but I was reaching out to every live organic body that was passing my table and collecting vital information about how to contact them. And then we subsequently had a conversation, and the counselor said, "Well, they don't look like a college material."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "How do you determine that? How do you know what are their potentials and what are their capacity?" But mostly because in this case, this is not a scientific evaluation of the process, but the person reached out to people who had light skin,
mm-hmm.
African-Americans, and slightly more dressed up.
Yeah, and that was, Vernet, you also responded to that as well about those, I think we're talking about those biases, these implicit biases when you're looking at someone and you don't think that they necessarily are the type of material to be in college, or perhaps they don't belong where they are. Talk about, I've heard you say before that these biases are basically stories that we've made up about other people that we've never met before. Tell us some more about that.
Yeah, it's really a way, we call it descriptive bias. I mean, there's so many types of biases, but this descriptive bias is that your brain is sorting through a lot of stimuli very quickly and trying to make decisions. That's how it moves along in the world. It can't fully appreciate every single piece of stimuli. So what happens is it's sorting very quickly, and the way it's trying to make sense of things is to look for patterns or themes or a schema, like what goes with what. That's how, I would say, in some ways, lazy it is, at least the fast brain, our fast brain. And so what it's doing is looking for descriptors or things that it thinks it already knows. And sadly, yes. In this country especially, but also in lots of parts of the world, black, brown, seemingly poor are pictures that go with not as smart or not as committed or not as trustworthy or dangerous. And so the brain is doing a very quick sort, and that's why in Raj's case, you look at a person and you think, not college, like this doesn't go with college, right?
Yeah.
And all of us do this. It's just a matter of knowing that we're doing it and trying to overcome it.
Yeah, I want to bring a caller in on this. I think we're has a question or comment about this same issue. Let's go to Wes is in Tampa, Florida. Wes, what's your contribution to this conversation?
Thank you for having me. I've lived and worked either full-time or part-time in 32 states within the United States. I grew up in South Carolina back in the 60s with racial segregation. I don't even know where to begin.
Well,
and it's happened so many times, but I must say this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
When I'm in uniform,
mm-hmm.
then nothing happens.
Mm.
And if you ever wonder why...
You're a law enforcement officer?
No, when I say uniform, I mean dressed up.
Okay, in a suit.
Black.
Okay, gotcha.
Yes, it's very expensive to be black in this country because one has to look a certain way in order for others to feel comfortable. You know, I was asked to be participate on a diversity program for two mm-hmm. major corporations in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, those one day, even a week programs, they do not work.
Yes, sir.
Hmm. What do they miss? What do they miss, those types of diversity trainings that you're talking about?
One vital thing, mm-hmm. talent. Hiring, it has to start from the top.
Mm-hmm.
Asking a manager to understand and to be diverse, it's like saying, if you want to be able to become a great singer, I'll take it, you can go to school and you can learn to be good. If you don't have the talent to become a singer, mm-hmm. you can train that person all you want to. They will not become one. There are lots of talents out there. Corporations do not hire. Birds of a feather flock together.
Yeah.
When you have someone at the top of the list, you honestly think they're going to bring someone, a subordinate, managers, low-level management, under sure. them that's going to think differently? Absolutely not.
Well, Wes, thank you for that comment. And Vernay, I want to ask you, because it sounds like this is also in your wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Are there certain things that you cannot train? I'm wondering if, you know, things like empathy and respect, that sort of thing, can you train that?
Oh, my gosh, what a great question. You know, I am in workplaces every day. And here's the thing. Training alone, right, is never going to be enough. Ultimately, people have to decide mm-hmm. that they want to open their mind mm-hmm. and their hearts, that they want to step into the shoes of someone else who may have a very different life experience in order to access what it's like to be a person of color, yes. or what is it like to be, you know, an LGBTQ person if you're straight. And so there has to be a desire. And I think the trainings can be very positive in the sense that, like, for example, with the Starbucks training, a lot of people are like, well, that's not going to do anything. Well, quite frankly, it could, because what they're trying to do is to give people information. So awareness is the beginning. And then you're actually in the seat as an individual to decide, what do you want to do with this new awareness, because lots of people don't understand or they haven't been exposed. I think the second thing is relationship. So what is also true is if you stay in your own corner or you stay in your own in-group, you don't get to understand or recognize or identify where you may have inaccurate understanding yeah. of other groups of people. So you kind of have to get closer to difference in order to even see that you are seeing people differently and erroneously. But that's something that's hard to legislate, except the workplace is the only place I can see that there's a possibility for it, because mm-hmm. we're still living in very sort of segregated ways. And so the workplace is a place where people come all together. And
yeah.
certainly with Starbucks, they've got people of every background, every ethnicity, all sorts of socioeconomic statuses. And so the idea that maybe a bunch of people all over the country today are going to get some new information that they had no access to, that could be quite promising.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I want to put out a call again to, if you're just listening to the program, I'm Brant Williams. I'm sitting in for Kerry Miller. This hour, we're talking about those recent incidents in which white people have called police about people of color who are apparently just doing things like maybe sitting in a Starbucks without buying anything or going on a tour of a college campus. My guests are Raj Sedaraju and Vernay Myers. I'm taking your calls, 651-227-6000. And toll free at 800-242-2828. And I want to know, if you've had an experience, like perhaps you're a person of color who has been the target of a police call, what was that like? Give us a call. Or if you've been a person who's felt it necessary to call the police, perhaps you're white and the people you're calling on are people of color, what led you to make that decision? Mm-hmm. Raj, let me go to you. You were nodding in to what Vernay was saying as well, when we're talking about this empathy and How much can you train, and how do you inspire someone to feel like they should care about and see the experiences of others before they take actions like, say, calling the police?
Yeah, thank you. And Vernay gave a beautiful definition of implicit bias. So thank you, Vernay, for that. I think when Vernay says, right, it's harder for us to build capacity for empathy, what I take and what I reflect on is the idea of how we approach our jobs. So if you are, as a law enforcement officer, you approach your job from the perspective of enforcement, then there is no room or capacity for empathy, right? So it's about how we navigate this idea of work from the perspective of value-centered versus work-centered and skill-centered. We can build the skills. You can teach somebody how to shoot. You can teach somebody how to drive. But as Mr. West from Florida said, it is not easy for people to be interested and be curious about developing an understanding of one. Because as Brian Stevens often says, right, it is important for us to close the proximity between us. We may live in a diverse community, but diversity is only at that sort of surface level of diversity. Yes, sure. I have a black friend, I have a Latino friend, I have an LGBTQIA friend.
Yeah.
But what do we really know about all of their lives, right? So this idea of really integrating ourselves and closing that proximity takes what Renee says, right, building relationships, value-centered relationships, so that we can undo and unpack the historical racialized practices that Mr. West says beautifully. He said, if I'm dressed a certain way, I fit a certain narrative. Sure. If I'm not dressed a certain way, I don't fit a certain narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got another caller on the line, too. I want to make sure I get to bring in as many folks into our conversation who are calling in. We're going to go to Carlos in Nicollet. Carlos, thank you so much for calling. What's your comment or question?
Hi, my name is Carlos. I'm actually calling from Maplewood, Minnesota. And, you know, you can, it's like the new thing now, calling the cops on us African-Americans.
Yes.
You know, you can put a suit and tie on racism, but it's still racism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it look innocent. But what's going to happen eventually is the cops is going to react to one of these calls, and hopefully not, but someone's probably going to lose their life, you know, on something simple as a, you know, like the lady a few weeks ago who called the cops on the guy who was barbecuing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and eventually something's going to spin out of control with one of these calls.
Carlos, yes. Thank you so much for that comment, because that's something I want to talk about with Raj as well, because a part of his area of expertise is in law enforcement practices. As we know, we've seen this many times where law enforcement officers show up in a situation, the situation escalates into where an officer uses deadly or lethal force, and this may have started over maybe nothing. And one of these instances, thank goodness, did not turn into a violent confrontation. Just, Raj, give me your sense of when you hear about these instances where police are called on somebody's shopping or suspected of shoplifting or something like that. What's your reaction? Are you thinking about that? Geez, this could have been really, really turned out badly.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'll quickly use an example, right? So I was grew up some in Louisiana and went to school in Louisiana. In one of these drives from Louisiana, from Monroe to Dallas, and then coming back on the way, we were stopped on whatever the Highway 20 or something like that. And the law enforcement officer, sheriff deputy, comes up, asked for the ID from the driver, and I wasn't driving, I was a passenger, and he leaves. And I was wondering what's going on. I stepped out of my car, and immediately he pulls his gun and points at me and commands that I get back in the car.
Wow.
And I was wondering, what the hell is going on? So I got back in the car somehow. I was on the right brain. I sat in my car. And I waited for my colleague to come back, and I asked him what happened. He said, well, you know, the deputy was wondering if we were drug dealers, because that's the profile of a drug dealer, a black guy and a white guy driving together
sure.
in a sort of a pickup truck-like structure.
Yeah.
So that experience, right, so the calls that comes in, how are those calls registered? So it comes through the dispatch, and how are dispatch units listening to this call? Because majority of these type of trainings never migrate to dispatch communities.
That's
they
what I wonder
simply
about.
Doing their job.
That's what I want to know. That's I cover law enforcement and criminal justice as mm-hmm. well, and my beat as a reporter.
Yeah.
And one thing that I've been curious about is to know how much the training is that dispatchers get in, especially in the situation of the barbecue in the park, yeah. right? Would a dispatcher be able to tell the officer or to tell the caller, this is not a high priority call? Perhaps you should call like our 311 or information line to complain about this. This isn't a police call.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you've gotten a sense of if that type of information is relayed to dispatchers, that they have perhaps authority to do that sort of thing.
I, I think they do. So part of this is discretion, and part of this is calls coming from different communities. So sometimes it's about how the caller is calling in and the emotions that are involved in that particular call then registers in a way that the dispatcher's discretion says this is high priority or a threat or something to be checked out by law enforcement. And so the transmission of that particular information then is verbalized and emotionalized and carries more weight, right, from where it started. Who transmitted and how it's transmitted then becomes carries weight. And so we also, for the most part, even in the latest discretion by the governor to spend more money in doing CIT training and crisis intervention training for law enforcement, millions of dollars are invested in the state of Minnesota. But who is really involved in this type of training?
Yeah.
Well, mostly police.
And well, I want to get to a caller who is going to talk a little bit about this. I want to go to Steve in St. Paul. Steve, what's your experience about this topic?
Well, I live in St. Paul. Lived in this particular house for about 12 years. And just after moving into the neighborhood, you know, a group of neighbors were sitting around talking one night and talking about how all these kids are smoking pot in their cars and how it's a nuisance and they don't want other kids seeing that. And then on the Facebook page, we have a neighborhood Facebook page, there were common refrains that the best thing to do if you're ever unsafe or unsure in a situation is to always call the police. That's the best thing to do, and the police were recommending to do so.
Yeah.
One Saturday afternoon, there was an SUV parked out in front of my house, and there were three or four people of color inside the vehicle, and the car had been sitting there. No one got in or out for, it had to have been well over a half an hour.
Yeah.
At which point my wife and I discussed it and said, you know, on Facebook it says call the police. You know, it's, if they're not doing anything wrong, no one will get hurt. This was probably back in 2007 or so, and before a lot of these situations were publicized. So we called the police, and right away I regretted it. The individuals were pulled from their car. Nothing violent happened, but it was two or three men and a woman, and they were all put in handcuffs as the police searched their vehicle.
Could you hear what the police were saying to them at the time? Were you outside?
No. I did not. I was too ashamed to even step out of my house. It's horrible.
Mm. Yeah.
And I regret it ever since then. And and I'm personally of the mindset now of call the police as the last possible thing to do in any situation, regardless what the situation is. Never call the police. Never call 911 because it's not safe for anybody. Whether a person's in a emotional crisis or anything, 911 is the last number to call.
Sure. Steve, thank you so much for that call. I really appreciate that. Vernay, just very quickly, we're going to go to a break in a minute, but what do you hear in Steve's voice when he tells his story?
Wow. First of all, thank you, Steve. What a difficult story, and to say it, he just said the shame, you know, and I think people see the police differently, but the conclusion he has now is the conclusion that a lot of black and brown and poor people have, which is the police are not necessarily there for us and are not going to necessarily operate in the best interest of everyone involved. I mean, that's the problem with automatic associations, implicit bias, right? So it becomes worse and you are not using your all of the information because you're in high risk. It's fast paced, and so your brain is just picking old ideas, and so it means that you are approaching the subjects with a whole different mindset, and it's not a mindset about de-escalation. It's around threat and fear, and I think a lot of black people feel that about the police. You got to remember, police were created to actually take care of the property of the well off, and they've been that way for
Still
a
to
very
keep the
long
peace.
Time, and to keep people separate from the has from the have-nots. That's what the police were about. Now, how they operate now, right now, it depends, I'm sure, from police department to police department, but a lot of it is about protecting property.
Yeah.
And so white people feel more comfortable with police, many do, many middle-class white people do, than others.
Well, Vernay, thank you for that. We're going to take more calls after a little break here. Again, if you're listening this hour, my name is Brant Williams. We're talking about these incidents in which white people have called police about people of color. We've got some guests here in the studio with me. I've got Raj Sadaraju and Vernay Myers. I'm also taking your calls at 651-227-6000 and toll-free at 800-242-2828. And right now on the phone, I'm going to open this up to Anthony Galloway is on our line. You may have heard Anthony. He is a host of our Counter Stories podcast and feature on NPR News. Anthony, I welcome your input on this topic. What's on your mind this morning?
And good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great, Anthony. What do you think?
Good. Well, you know, and I'm sorry, actually. This is Anthony Taylor, and I've actually been a guest on a few of the shows. But what was really listening to the show, what was on my mind was really some of the work that we've really been doing specifically around kind of equity and green spaces, which is really high on work here, as well as Vision Zero work and work that's happening in active transportation, and how we're actually interacting with communities of color and the challenges for African-American communities as they make this shift towards being more visible in public.
Well, thank you for that. Raj, let's talk a little bit about, as we left off before the news, we were talking about a call from a man who had called police on a group of people of color who were out in front of his house. And in a lot of these cases that we're seeing in the news and on social media, we're seeing African-Americans in spaces like, say, the student at Yale University who is napping in a dorm lounge. There's this, the subtext here is that this black person did not belong in this lounge at Yale in these spaces. What's your sense of when police are the answer to responding to a black person who is perceived as not being where they're supposed to be?
Yeah, so this idea of people don't belong to that space goes back. I mean, in Harvard, they had a movement where people, the students, were ultimately frustrated that they do belong. They are Harvard. And UCLA had the same type of issues. And Iowa State, one of the universities there in Iowa, also had the same type of issues where students were clamming to say that we are present here, right? Recognize our humanity and our presence here and don't dismiss us because we don't fit your narrative. I wonder... reiterate what Verna said about this idea of this using police, the thin blue line, as Alexis Vitale calls it, the thin blue line, to separate the haves and the have-nots, right? So it's a classic Marxian perspective about how we separate those who fit our narrative of success, of fitting into a particular line of thinking that is often promoted in the form of patriotism and others, and then those who don't fit in. And I think I want to go back to that story about this not calling the police. There's a beautiful story on YouTube that anybody can look at, where a couple who lives in a cul-de-sac in California decided that they look out their door and it's always rubbish and things clamoring in their space and people always crowding their space in the evenings. And they didn't know what to do about all of these kinds of businesses, transactions that were taking place. And so instead of calling the police, one day the husband decided that he's going to just take the Buddhist statue he bought and put it and planted outside and cemented it to one of the on the side street.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, people started to come to that space in a different meaning, right? Establish different meaning. And what happened is that Vietnamese communities that lived there came and swept the place, cleaned up the space. And all of a sudden, you saw people stopping there and just do a quick prayer for the day. And you saw the crime, the activities, the transactions that were taking place started to move away from that community. They didn't require any law enforcement.
Sure.
It's just a simple mindset to say, how do I engage in my community? And Steve, I appreciate you saying that you regret it, but many of us don't think. We are impulsive. So it is not just implicit biases for the police, but we also, communities of especially white, richer communities need to understand how we have educated them and painted a narrative about law enforcement as the peacekeepers.
Sure.
Right? And another quick example, I was just in St. Paul Police Department, And they have this picture, right, peacekeepers, and this narrative about Matthew 5-9, peacekeepers, and it paints police officers as if they are the sons of God who keep the peace. It's a difficult narrative for me to own.
Sure.
Right.
Well, I want to bring in some more callers as well into this conversation as we're rolling through it. Let's go to Dan in Minneapolis. Dan, what's your comment or question for our guests this morning?
Yeah, well, thanks for taking my call. An excellent conversation. I just wanted to share that I recently, over the last 3 years, have worked in a more diverse environment than I had before with a lot of African Americans. And something occurred here during about the last year that really opened my eyes. But first of all, just, you know, getting to know people in the work environment, you know, in and of itself was an eye-opening experience and, you know, broadened my perspective. But at some point about a year ago, workplace decided, because it's big enough, they wanted to issue parking passes so that they could identify the cars in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And within about a week, some of the African Americans were entering into kind of a conversation with leadership, like, well, we really don't want to hang these from our rear view mirrors. Is there some other place we can put them in the car? Because from their perspective, what they saw was, we're going to be pulled over because we're going to be pulled over for obstructed view as a reason to pull them over. And it was, from my perspective, getting to know some of my coworkers and just learning to love them and appreciate the diversity and what they bring to bear, it was just absolutely heartbreaking.
Yeah.
To realize, you know, the situation that they're in versus myself, you know, white Caucasian. And I just think it's a shame that we target people in our community who are parents and neighbors and brothers and sisters and really can add to the knowledge and experience that we have in our communities.
Dan, thank you for that.
Instead we're targeting them. And, you know, all I could think is, these people leave work every day to come to work.
Sure.
And on the way to work, they're targets. And every day when they leave work, they leave and are becoming targets. It's just sad.
Dan, thank you for that comment. Vernay, it sounds like perhaps you've heard folks like Dan in some of the trainings that you've been a part of.
Yeah, our company does trainings like this all the time, where we're trying to get people to understand exactly what Stan said, which is, these are people. They're like fully multidimensional, multi-identity, multi-responsibility people. And the problem, and I think Raj said this, which was really important, is that we've got to develop a very different sense of curiosity about individuals. And one of the problems with bias, right, is that if you think you already know who people are and you've slotted them into stereotypes, whether they're good or bad, you lose your curiosity for them. Mm. And so we need to actually, one, just be curious enough to say, what's your life experience and how is it like mine, and also in what ways does it differ? But also to see people as more than one thing. When police are taking people down and they don't even know who they are, when people are calling on folks who are napping, they have one story of that person. And that is a really, really powerful and dangerous thing. Yeah. To see someone and only see them in one way and not fully experience them as a human being. Because once we see them as a human being, then there are more opportunities for connection. And through those connections, you start to expand your concept of who that person is. And it's very mutual.
Yeah.
So I see this a lot in the workplace, but somehow when we go through these trainings, people get that information like Stan spoke of, which is, wow, I never knew that this was your life.
Sure.
And I'm sorry about it. I'm sad about it. And I want to talk about it.
Right. And, you know, I'm going to hear some comments that we've received here, some folks who couldn't hang on to the line. We had Tammy in Minneapolis say, there's a lot of fear in the air. Awareness is a tool to unite people. We need to have education of history, cultures. We need to unite. We've had a caller from, his name is Matt Menominee. He said, I'm white. Will people become afraid to call law enforcement? And we've also heard from folks online who said, I think that young people are paying attention to this issue and will think twice before calling the cops. But what can be done to help older generations to see the police differently and to think twice before calling the cops on people of color? These are all very interesting comments. And I'll open up Raj, any of those things that you heard that sparked a response from you?
Yes. Some people refer to it as the Ferguson effect in terms of not and police not stopping people of color because of the fear of the and what it might look like for the public media. And then there are people who are
police saying, splashed all over Facebook or Twitter or somebody, a traffic stop gone bad.
Exactly.
That sort of thing.
And the fear on people thinking like, should I call the police? Should I not call the police? But if we are a community that has relationship and know each other and know our community really well, we are less likely to step into that mix. And we are able to even describe the situation without fear, right? When we do indeed call police, we are able to describe it without showing off as if we are in life-threatening situation. And so we are able to, because as Renee said, if we understand our neuroscience, we understand that sometimes we operate from our brainstem, right? The fight, flight, freeze mode. And when we are in that particular section of our brain, we often are not critically thinking about the situation. We are simply spewing the fear, and that fear and emotion is carried on to law enforcement.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to harp on law enforcement per se, but as a culture, as Renee pointed out, our law enforcement history is a history that is based on colonialism, that is based on ideologies of racism, right? Yes, in South Carolina and Texas Rangers, right? Mm-hmm. Idea of harming and hurting the native people of Mexican heritage in those days before it became Tejas became Texas. Right, that space, all of these spaces, the idea and the ideology of white supremacist ideology pervades this particular and undergirds how we operate to this day.
Are law enforcement officials that you speak with, do you think they're getting that? Do you think they have a clear sense of history? Are they open to discussing the history of racism in this country when you go to talk to them about how they practice their craft?
I have to say yes, right? Rondo in Minneapolis, the police chief, as well as
Medira Arredondo.
Chief Axtell and others do understand. They have done initiatives like taking people over to the African American Museum in D.C. and exploring the history, the racial history. But what is not done properly, as Vitaly points out, that in the end of policing, that it is not enough to just simply come here and do training per se and then say, okay, go out there and practice.
Yeah.
But it is about how are we building capacity for interactions to happen and closing the proximity, as Brian Stevens would say, and being willing to be vulnerable so that I am asking questions to learn, right? So the idea that this brother talked to me about in Stillwater Prison, he said, yo, man, listen, learn. And then lead.
Yeah.
Right? It's about this idea of listening and learning. It is not just a one-time exposure.
And thanks. And I'm going to get to some more callers here because we have a lot of folks online. And it looks like we've got a lot of interesting comments that will contribute to our conversation. Let's go to Annette in Minneapolis. Annette, what's your comment or question for our guest today?
Hi there. Several years ago, I worked in a little floral shop in the neighborhood. It's in South Minneapolis. So it's a very mixed neighborhood, and my family is mixed, so that's part of why I was happy to be there. And during prom season, a young man came in the day, the Monday after prom and said, gosh, I spent $45 to get a corsage for my date. My friend came to pick it up and was told he couldn't take it. I would just like my money back. And I said, let me get the manager. I can't do that. The manager took one look at the young man and called the police.
Hmm.
Wow. Right. Okay. It was a young man and his friend and another buddy. And there's, the buddies are standing there with their hands in their pockets, bored. They're not doing anything.
Yeah.
But they're all black. But I had known them casually since middle school because my daughter was in the same grade.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it that she called the police immediately.
Wow. And did you confront her about that?
I did a little bit. I was like, what? But one of the designers who, let's put it really bluntly, he came from a family with money. He was only working there because he liked designing flowers, right?
Okay.
He looked at her and said, you can't do that. And she said, don't tell me what to do. And he said, no, this is really racist. You just can't do it. So he jumped all over her he didn't need the job.
Right? Yeah.
My husband's disabled. I wasn't trying to lose the job, but I did say a couple things. But I also, when she kept saying that, you know, that she, you know, the police could handle it, I went to the young men and I said, I'm really sorry. I recognize you guys, but I'm getting really scared for you.
Yeah. And that thing. I'm sorry, Annette, we've got a couple of more folks I want to get to online here, but thank you for that story. Vernay, I think that also exemplifies something that we've also been seeing in some of these other instances where there have been white people on site of some of these, like at the Starbucks, who have questioned the decision to call the police on these African Americans. What does that tell you?
Well, I think it goes back to what Raj was saying, which is the need for community. And when, you know, I'm in the workplace and my company we're working on these ideas of how to increase inclusion in the workplace, we're trying to appeal to community. We're trying to ask people to stand up when they see something. And it's starting to happen where more people are getting more aware and they're seeing their connection in a community with others, and they're standing up and saying, this is not okay. And I think the best thing that has happened from all of the recognition of the many men and women of color who've been killed by police or in many ways injured, that people are starting to pay attention. They are becoming more awake to what is happening, and they're saying, no, this is not okay. And that's what we need if we want to change our behavior. There has to be enough people who are saying, wait, this does not seem right to me.
Well, and what's the role of social media in that? Because a lot of these have come to our attention because somebody took the time to capture that.
Yeah, they were happening all along, but now you can, because of social media, you can see the pattern. And when you see the pattern, that's where you see that this is not just one individual being overly sensitive or getting it wrong or deserving it. You can see, you get enough data that says, wait, this is a social problem. This is a cultural embedded problem, and it must be fixed.
You know, and I wonder, Vernay, though, if in some of these instances, I mean, when we see these types of incidents portrayed on social media, if how it affects the types of response that we have. I'm wondering if you think that sometimes this may just reinforce or discourage people from talking. Perhaps there are people who maybe have a different point of view on what happened. Maybe they feel like, well, maybe this was warranted for that person to call the police. Perhaps it makes this person feel less willing to contribute their voice to the conversation because they feel like they're going to be shouted down.
Yeah, I think all of those are possible. I mean, I'm not a social scientist, so I'm not sure how it all plays out. I know one aspect of it is that because we can see the interactions, it's not just reported by the person who experienced it. We're having a chance to really evaluate ourselves. And yes, you know, you need context, and the videos don't show you everything. But I think what happened in Milwaukee with Sterling Brown from the Bucks, and you start to see, even with the Starbucks, you see these black men comporting themselves perfectly, which is hard to do when you're thinking you could be taken down at any moment and killed or put on a stranglehold for no reason. But you see these people comporting themselves with perfect decorum and still having this really negative interaction. And so in some places, yes, some people might be saying, well, I'd like to speak up and say, I think that you shouldn't have been in a Starbucks anyway. But it does allow people, I think, or it takes away the excuse of, well, that's just what that person thinks, because now more people are weighing in and seeing it.
Right. And speaking of law enforcement, we have a caller on the line, Matt in Duluth, who I believe is a law enforcement officer. Matt, is that right?
That's correct.
And what's your thoughts when you about this conversation?
So there's one thing one of your guests said about 2 or 3 minutes ago that really struck me, talking about trying to, I guess, understand the people that you're interacting with and dealing with as a full person and not just, you know, a snapshot within that moment. I think a big problem here is just cross-cultural communication between, you know, the general public at large, communities of color in particular, and law enforcement, which is in itself a culture. I think we need to do a better job as law enforcement officers of having that cultural competency and seeing that full person. But at the same time, and I think this is partially on us for not articulating it well to the general public, but we do some things in a use of force situation that look really, really bad.
Sure.
But we have reasons to do it. And I think we as law enforcement officers need to come out and be more available to sort of answer those questions about, hey, why did he do that? But I'd also like to ask the general public to kind of seek some of those answers from law enforcement and not just assume, you know, from their perspective, what's going on.
Yeah. And Matt, tell me, what kind of training do you go through this, the type of implicit bias training that other law enforcement officers do around the state?
Yep. Our agency has been doing it recently. I grew up in a very diverse environment to begin with. So I guess, and sometimes that can be sort of a minority in law enforcement. I mean, a lot of folks are, you know, they don't grow up in with an opportunity to sort of experience interacting with a wide range of people to begin with.
And you're white? You're a white person?
Yep, yeah. Correct. I'm white. Yeah. And I live in a majority white area. You know, we're an agency that serves a very much majority white community. But we do have folks of color here. You know, we deal with a lot of folks from Native communities,
sure.
Some African-Americans as well. And, you know, frankly, a lot of times on, you know, a traffic stop or a law enforcement interaction, they're model citizens in that they know, you know, exactly where we want their hands. They know exactly, you know, what we want from them, and they'll ask very specific questions. And
that's
one thing I'll do is just try to put them at ease right away and say, hey, man, we're just going to work through our traffic stop here. I understand this is probably a stressful situation for you, but, you know, we got some business we need to take care of. And as long as we can take care of that, everything's going to be fine.
Hey.
And I think just that person-to-person personalization goes a long way towards taking some of the air out of the situation.
Hey, Matt, thanks you so much for that call and for your perspective. And Raj, you were chomping at the bit to get in here. What's your reaction when you hear a law enforcement officer talk about how he approaches a situation where he's dealing with people of color who may have a different perspective or experience dealing with law enforcement?
And is Matt from Duluth, you said?
In Duluth, yeah.
In Duluth. So, Matt, I appreciate the call and appreciate Brent for asking me to respond to this. The interesting thing about Duluth is that the police chief has come out and said and really established a better understanding of his connection to the lynching that happened in the 1920s in Duluth, one of the last places to have a mass lynching process. And a group of people from Duluth and many parts of Minnesota recently went down to Alabama with Brian Stevens to visit with the new lynching memorial.
And you've mentioned Brian Stevens a couple times. Yeah. Just explain really in a sentence about what the work he does.
He just wrote the book, Just Mercy, and an amazing TED Talk. And if people are interested, he works with young people who are trapped in the system.
Sure.
And really try to bring people out of the system, especially young people and people who have been in the system without proper identification with the crime that they've been accused of committing.
Okay. And sorry, I wanted to make sure we're clear on that because I've read some of his stuff too.
Yeah. So to answer, Matt's response is wonderful, right? So Matt described this idea of procedural justice in the way how you communicate, how you connect with the person you have just stopped. And and rightfully, he is right to describe it is stressful to have these blaring lights go off right yeah. behind you, and you have somebody walking with you, and he or she or they might have their hands on the gun, not knowing who they are going to approach. I appreciate the idea of that building a better capacity and hiring police officers who have an interest and curiosity and relational in nature, who can carry out the skills they have been taught. This
yeah.
is what, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates often say.
Yeah.
The idea that police is an authority, not power.
Sure. And thank you for making that point as well. And we're getting towards the end of our conversation. I'm going to wrap it up here. And Vernay, before we end, I want to ask you about something that you said when we're looking forward at how we can have the types of discussions that we need to have. I heard you say to tell folks to stop trying to be good people. We need real people. How do people become real in this context?
Yeah, thank you for for asking me that. First of all, I've loved this conversation. I appreciate so much the callers and also Raj as well. I think it's about deciding to get out of denial. There are a lot of us who are so focused on being good and having this sense of ourselves as good and kind people that we aren't willing to look a little bit more deeply at the way in which all of us have been contaminated by racism and sexism and really white supremacy. And it's not because we're bad people, but if we really want to be real, then we have to acknowledge the extent to which we've been influenced by stereotypes and then work really hard to counter that and to change our behavior and to pay attention to our behavior and at times to stand up and speak up. And so that's what really good is going. That's the kind of good we need.
Well, Renee, thank you so much. And thank you so much for that. We're going to wrap it up right here. But I want to thank you so much for contributing to our conversation. That was Renee Myers. She's an author and cultural innovator. We also heard from Raj Sidharaju, assistant professor at Metro State University. Thank you again for your calls. You were listening to Minnesota Public Radio News.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.